Welcome. As I was considering what to bring up this evening, I was thinking about our upcoming class series on the Lankavatara Sutra, and we've been waiting for Red Pine's new translation of this sutra for this class. And I thought this morning, if that translation arrives today, that's what I'll speak about tonight. And so it arrived today. So to begin the exploration of this brand new, hot off the presses, a translation of Lankavatara Sutra. First, a little teaching on how to listen to Dharma. There's a traditional teaching. It's brings up the image of a cup. How to be like a cup to receive the tea of Dharma. A precious Dharma that comes in all these different forms, and sometimes it might seem like, oh, we've heard all these things so many times, and we kind of check out. So there's always something valuable to hear fresh and new. And thus there are these three faults of the cup when receiving the nectar or tea of Dharma. One is to listen to Dharma like a cup turned upside down, which obviously doesn't receive very much. It makes a big splashed puddle all around the outside of it. And that would be just like, yeah, I'm coming to the Dharma talk again, but like I have a lot of things going on, and now that I'm starting to hear this drone of words, I think let me process how the day went and how tomorrow will go, and I've got better things to think about than this same old stuff. So, and I know how easy it is to feel that way. That's kind of like maybe going to sleep also is like the cups slowly turn upside down and there's Dharma pouring all over the top, but it's just spreading out, and then afterwards, what was that about? I have no idea. And another fault of the cup is like to have crack in the bottom or holes in the bottom where the Dharma is pouring into an upright cup, but it's leaking out the bottom as quickly as it's being poured in. So this is another case where we're actually like, yeah, we're listening, we got it. But then again, at the end, like, there's nothing left. What was that about? It kind of has flowed out. So how do we stop up the leaks in the bottom of our Dharma receiving cup? Maybe just a matter of paying attention and applying to our experience as we're hearing the words. And with that inspired verse with which we would begin Dharma talks, unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma is rarely met with in these eons of time. So remembering, oh, this is this scenario here is this rare, precious event, even if it just seems like the same old thing. And the third problem with cup is, if it's inside of the cup is dirty or even like poisoned. So as the nectar, the, like tea, is poured in, it gets all mixed together with the grime and grease on the inside of the cup, and the straightforward Buddha Dharma is all gets all murky and mixed together. You could say, what's the dirt on the inside of the cup would be like our maybe judgmental thoughts about this isn't so useful really, or I don't agree with this, or that's not like how I heard it, or that's exactly how I heard it, so I can fall asleep now, or whatever. All our discriminating thoughts that prevent us from just receiving into the pure, empty, open cup. The Dharma that's coming to us. So with this in mind, this would apply to any hearing or reading or receiving any type of Dharma teaching. So we become an upright, unleaky, clean cup and receive. So Red Pine, in this, his introduction here, his preface, which is as far as I got today, has a nice introduction to this Lankavatara Sutra. We only have one other translation in English so far by D.T. Suzuki from, I think, 1930, way back. So this is a fresh update. And he comments on the differences that he, what he's translating from and some of the history. And he, and how challenging this sutra is to understand. This is the, one of the foundational sutras for what we call a Yogacara, the yoga practice school, also called mind only. Tradition, the Chittamatra school of Indian Buddhism. This Lankavatara Sutra and the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, the sutra unlocking, the unraveling the deep mysteries we studied last year, are considered the two foundational scriptural sources for Yogacara, or mind only. So, Red Pine, the American translator here, says, although making sense of the sutra has been challenging, I'm surprised how straightforward it became once I found the two threads that held this sutra together. Basically, the teaching of the Lankavatara is similar to the approach used by later Zen teachers who offered their disciples a cup of tea and then asked them to taste the tea. This is how he puts the two threads of the sutra. Offering the tea, ideally to a cup that's right side up with no leaks and clean. It's a classical Zen teaching style to offer a cup of tea. And you can have one after this talk. It's over next door there. Zen masters offered their disciples a cup of tea and then asked them to taste the tea. The cup of tea, in this case, is the Buddha's teaching that traces the universe of our awareness, be it mundane or metaphysical, back to our mind. Here he says, this is the cup of tea into which this sutra is poured. The Buddha expresses this teaching by describing the world we think of as real, as the Sanskrit term, svachitta drish, shyamatra, which means nothing but the perceptions of our own mind. By this, he does not mean that the mind sees or that something is seen by the mind, for any subject or object would be yet another projection of the mind. The Buddha simply means that whatever we see or think or feel is our own mind, which is, of course, a tautology. A equals A. But then, what Buddhist teaching isn't a tautology? So that's the first thread that he finds here, is that everything is our own mind. Everything is mind only, thus becoming the name of this way of looking at the world. Having put this cup of tea into our hands, the Buddha then asks us to taste the tea to experience the tautology for ourselves. The phrase he uses to express this is, in Sanskrit, pratyatmagati, or personal inner or self-realization, or the realization of Buddha knowledge, noble wisdom, arya jnana. The importance of this, which is repeated over and over in these and similar words, was not lost on D.T. Suzuki, the previous translator, who noted, "The Lankavatara has come to see that the whole of the Buddhist life is not merely in seeing into the truth, but in living it and experiencing it." So these two threads are understanding how everything we experience is merely mind, and that we have to experience this for ourselves personally and beyond all the ideas and challenging concepts offered in a text like this, directly and straightforwardly. And it's particularly this second aspect, this personal, experiential, direct realization outside of words, that makes this one of the important sutras of the early Zen tradition. So it's said that Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen in China, who brought Zen, what we call Zen, from India to China, brought only this one sutra with him. This was the teaching that he brought from India to China. It was already around in China, not very long before Bodhidharma, but the sutra was circulating a little bit. According to Red Pine's history, it's like no one really noticed it or read it. It was just around. But Bodhidharma said, this is like the essence of the Buddha's teaching. We have this, maybe possibly the earliest so-called Zen writing ever, in this book, Zendan, and it's the was found in the Dunhuang Caves. It's this record of the teachers and students of the Lanka, or the Lankavatara Sutra. So these first Zen ancestors were learning, practicing, teaching, and passing on this Lankavatara Sutra, according to ancient history. And Bodhidharma said, as he was getting ready to see off his disciple Huayka after they practiced together for a while, said something like, "I have the Lankavatara Sutra in four scrolls, which I will give to you. This contains the essentials of the Tathagata's spiritual teaching and allows all beings to realize awakening. If you practice according to it, you will naturally be liberated." And so the sutra got passed along for a while. in the early days of Zen in China, and then gradually, not exactly disappeared into obscurity, but maybe got emphasized less. The Prajnaparamita Sutras came more to the fore. As Red Pine says, his speculation is because they're actually easier to deal with, like the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra. Now, experientially, we could probably say they're not any easier to deal with, but to understand what the words are talking about, they just point to the absence of any inherent nature in anything. They don't talk so much about how the mind creates delusion and how the mind is turned to drop away delusion and realize Buddha nature. So Bodhidharma, in one of his writings called The Treatise on Contemplating Mind, speaks in a way that is very much based on this mind-only tradition and the teachings of the Lankavatara Sutra. But this is kind of a Zen way of talking now, not so complicated. Hueka, his disciple, again asked, if there are people intent on seeking the Buddha way, what method should they practice? What method is most essential and concise? That's a kind of Zen way of asking, like, what's the essential, concise, most important teaching here? We don't have time for messing around with a lot of extra stuff. And Bodhidharma answered, let them just contemplate mind. Only contemplate mind. Contemplate mind only. This one method takes in all practices and is indeed essential and concise. And Hueka, with maybe just a bit of doubt, asks, well, how can one method take in all practices? Bodhidharma answered, mind is the root of the myriad phenomena. All phenomena are born from mind only. All phenomena are born from mind only. Other places in the sutra, such as the Lankavatara Sutra, says all phenomena are mind only. Sometimes it's said mind only, but then we might wonder, well, then our phenomena is like this book. A mind, it doesn't think like a mind, right? So it's not really a mind. So sometimes the word used is like concept or mental construction only. Which is kind of like Bodhidharma saying, all things are born from mind. If you can completely comprehend mind, the myriad practices are complete. It's like a great tree. All the branches and flowers and fruits grow based on the root. The tree grows only if the root survives. If the root is cut, the tree is sure to die. He doesn't explain this metaphor, but we could see it as take care of the study and practice of the tree root, and all the other practices, which are like the branches and leaves, will be taken care of. Or we could see it as when he says, the tree only grows if the root survives. If the root is cut, the tree is sure to die. We could say all those branches and leaves are like all our deluded, discriminating thoughts based on mind. So if the root source of delusion is cut, meaning like cut through with our sword of wisdom, then all the delusions just wither away, because they're all based on one delusion of mind. If you cultivate the way by comprehending mind, you save effort and success is easy. If you cultivate the way without comprehending mind, then you waste effort and there's no benefit. Thus we know that all good and bad come from one's own mind. If you seek outside of mind, it's impossible. Why is contemplating mind called complete comprehension? Huayka asks Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma answers, when the great bodhisattvas practice the profound perfection of wisdom, the prajna paramita, they comprehend that the four great elements, earth, wind, fire, water, and the five aggregates of body and mind are fundamentally empty and selfless. They see that there are two different kinds of activity initiated by mind. So this part is also coming from the spirit of the sutra. Two different kinds of activity. And it's like there's only two kinds of activity coming from mind, according to Bodhidharma. Pure states of mind and defiled states of mind. Pure mind is the mind of undefiled true suchness. Defiled mind is the mind of ignorance. These two kinds of mind are both there of themselves from the beginning. Though everything is produced by the combination of temporary causes, pure suchness mind always takes delight in the good, while this ignorant mind is constantly thinking in these false and harmful ways. If true suchness is aware of itself and, being aware, does not accept these defilements and distortions of thought, then this is called being wise. The Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, says, within the bodies of sentient beings, there is an indestructible Buddha nature. It's like the orb of the sun. Its body is bright and round and full and vast without limit because it's covered by the black clouds of the five aggregates. It's like a lamp placed in a jar so that the light cannot appear. And Bodhidharma, who said that the Zen is this special transmission outside the scriptures, quotes another scripture. The Nirvana Sutra says, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Because it is covered over by ignorance, they're not set free. Buddha nature is awakeness or awareness. When it's aware of itself and its awareness is completely illuminated apart from what covers it, this is called liberation. Now, what's interesting here, that Bodhidharma says, is that from the beginning, we all have these two streams, both born of mind, we could say streaming side by side, the mind of delusion that sees the external world as apart from mind, as existing in and of itself, on its own, or even if we not on its own, at least it doesn't depend on our mind to be the world. That's how we usually think. That's one stream of thought. And then there's this other stream of thought that's like Buddha nature. Completely pure, true suchness. Where one realizes that all is mind only. side by side, they, I mean, metaphorically speaking, it's not really like there's two streams, but in order to talk about it, we could say side by side, these two streams flow along from birth to death to birth to death. The obscured delusion that all this stuff is all this stuff, and the unobscured true suchness that there's no inside, outside, or in between. And so this theme will run through the Lakavatara Sutra also. So just to celebrate the sutra a little bit, you can hear the very beginning. Maybe we'll read the beginning many times. Chapter 1. King Ravana's request. Thus have I heard. This is the way that in Buddha Dharma, in our eon on this planet, from the beginning of the Buddha's teaching, all Buddha sutras are marked by this phrase. To show that they're spoken by Ananda, Buddha's faithful attendant who listened to every word the Buddha ever said, apparently. He had like photographic memory. And he once made a request to the Buddha that he said, I'll only be your attendant on these, you know, with these certain conditions. And the Buddha asked him to be attendant. He said, only if you let me hear every teaching that you ever give. So you invite me everywhere you go. And if I happen to miss one, you give like a spontaneous teaching while I'm in the bathroom. You have to give it again for me later. Or somehow make sure that I hear it. And this would be very useful for later generations. Even in those distant times in that land called America, where they will hear in their own language these many, many sutras of the Buddha, only because I heard them all and remembered them all, and then, you know, recited them back for recording in later times. So if you're wondering if it's a sutra of the Buddha, they virtually always begin, thus have I heard. It doesn't say, thus I, Ananda, have heard, but that's the story. I, in this case, is Ananda. And it's kind of nice, too, that it's the very first word of every sutra is thus. True thusness is the undefiled stream of Buddha nature, perfectly pure from the very beginning. So however we hear it, obscured or unobscured, thus have I heard once the Bhagavan, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was staying in the South Seas, on the peaks of Lanka, in a place adorned by countless jewels and flowers. Now, there might be some debate about this Lanka, but it seems pretty clear that it's referring to Sri Lanka, which I think is these days called Sri Lanka, as opposed to Ceylon, which it was called for a while. I think originally it was called Sri Lanka, and then somehow it got to be Ceylon, and I think I've heard somewhere that this is this island country just south of India. I think I heard that they, you know, to honor their great ancient heritage of Sri or Holy Lanka, they renamed it their original name, Sri Lanka. A lot of places in India too, it seems like different cities in India are gradually going back to their 1,000-year-old original names to kind of honor that heritage, which I think is very beautiful. So there's these stories about this island called Lanka that's, according to the stories, is very close to present-day Sri Lanka, so probably that's what it is. And for those who know the Ramayana, that great Hindu legend, apparently somewhere in there it talks about Sri Lanka and this King Ravana, who's actually a Rakshasa. You know, Rakshasas. Rock and Shasas. Well, they rock. This King Ravana of Sri Lanka was a ten-headed Rakshasa, who is like a... Rakshasas are these spirits that feed on human flesh, and they like to desecrate graves and harass priests. And they're in the Ramayana, they're born... Am I saying that right? Ramayana? They're born from Brahma's feet. And they're also these powerful warriors and magicians. And so this Ravana, in book 3 of the Ramayana, kidnapped Rama's wife, Sita, and took her to this palace in the island of Lanka. And... So, therefore, of course, later Rama came and attacked Sri Lanka and killed Ravana and took Sita back. You know that story? Mm-hmm. Is that part? Is it get enacted in the Ramayana play?
Every year.
That actual part of. Does Ravana actually have 10 heads in the play?
Yes.
Cool. We might have to, you know, take the Lankavatara Sutra class to this play. So this is one of these examples how this character and this, like a little section of this epic ancient Hindu story is just like, kind of like plunked into the beginning of this Buddha Sutra. Kind of strange in that way. And just at the beginning, there's this little scene with Ravana and the Buddha, and then another bodhisattva comes and, you know, questions the Buddha for the rest of the sutra. But at the beginning here, in addition to an assembly of great monks, the Buddha was also joined by a host of great bodhisattvas from other Buddha lands, led by Mahamati Bodhisattva Mahasattva. They were masters of every kind of samadhi, spiritual power, and psychic ability, and were the recipients of the blessings of countless Buddhas. Skilled in the knowledge that external objects are perceptions of one's own mind, they had opened doors of liberation for beings of every mental and physical capacity, and were thoroughly versed in the 5 dharmas, the 3 natures, the 8 consciousnesses, and the 2 kinds of no-self. So, that also is, this is just setting the stage here. And all these lists will be expounded upon in great detail in this sutra. At that time, the Bhagavan had been expounding the Dharma for 7 days in the palace of Sagara, the serpent king, which is, I think, underwater near the island. Upon reappearing, he was welcomed by Shakara and Brahma and a host of serpent maidens. Lifting his eyes and beholding Lanka's Mount Malaya, which is an interesting little play, because a lot of what's going to be talked about in this sutra is Alaya, the Alaya consciousness, the storehouse consciousness. So the mountain at the center of this island of Sri Lanka is called Mount Malaya. And the Buddha smiled and said, on Lanka's Mount Malaya, the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones of the past, have taught the self-realization of Buddha knowledge. So this is, so now we've heard these two streams have been introduced. That Red Pine mentions these bodhisattvas that are skilled in the knowledge that external objects are mere perceptions of one's own mind. And then this is where the Tathagatas, the Buddhas, have taught the self-realization of Buddha knowledge, the direct experiential realization itself. So both these themes have been introduced, like in the first paragraph. The self-realization of Buddha knowledge, which is beyond the comprehension of Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, or the mistaken knowledge of followers of other paths. Today, for the sake of Ravana, ruler of the Yakshas, I too will teach this teaching. Ruler of the Yakshas and Rakshasas. Buddha knew that the Bhagavan had reappeared from the Serpent King's palace, accompanied by Shakra and Brahma and countless serpent maidens, and he saw the thoughts of those in that assembly, stirred by the wind of externality and rising like so many waves in the oceans of their storehouse consciousness. So this is the Buddha's thought, that he saw the thoughts of those in the assembly, the thoughts stirred by the wind of externality. That's what were happening to us 24/7. Our thoughts are being stirred by the wind of externality, like the world out there. Even in our dreams, it appears to be an external world. And rising like so many waves in the oceans of their storehouse consciousness. So these thoughts, moment-to-moment arisings of an appearance of an external world, are like waves arising out of the surface of this vast ocean called the storehouse consciousness, Alaya Vijnana. Ravana shouted joyfully, I will go and invite the Bhagavan to Lanka for the lasting happiness and welfare of humans and devas. So the sutra begins with the Buddha emerging from the ocean and then looking at this vast assembly waiting for him to teach the Lankavatara Sutra. And seeing how the thoughts of all those beings are like these waves stirred by the winds of externality. The winds of the objective world, the winds of like all this stuff that seems to be out there, stir this vast ocean of storehouse consciousness, and they create these waves of experience. And he smiled. So, by the way, Lankavatara. The avatara part, As you may know, this word avatar means like a, it's like when a spirit of a being like descends into or enters into like an embodiment, like on earth. That's like an avatar of that being, of that holy being, we might say. You know, that, that movie Avatar, right? About the, where the person could like enter into the body of this creature on another planet. So, but it literally means like descent into, entering into. It's an avatar, so it's the Lanka Avatara. It's the Buddha's descent or entering into Lanka, Sri Lanka, to teach the sutra. So I hope to keep bringing up the sutra as the practice period begins in a few weeks and before and after. And maybe the one of our main focuses of study for this year of 2012 with this wonderful new well-annotated translation by Red Pine. He's got half of his, is just his notes and half is the translation. And study lots of words and notes and at the same time know that meanwhile there's this direct unelaborated experience of suchness that's just hidden below the words. So for now, any questions or comments on Bodhidharma's teaching or this sutra and the waves of externality, the winds of externality churning up the waves of consciousness? Yes.
And you read the part about, when you said that about understanding mind, most of what you read was about understanding mind.
Yes.
But then there was part of what you read that said understanding your own mind.
Mm.
And that's what I kind of wonder if the storehouse mind is kind of a suchness that doesn't, isn't associated with self.
Mm-hmm.
And that other mind that I forgot what you said was.
Like the waves in the water. Or dualistic consciousness, discriminating mind.
That's more what we think of as our own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we say it's important to study mind, I think I've, normally when I hear that, I think it's important to study how my mind deludes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But is it more studying that larger?
Yeah, there's a lot in that question, that multiple part question. And of course, this this teaching will go into a lot of details, but basically, mind is different from self. In all Buddha's teachings, we see that like a true fixed abiding self at our core can never be found. And yet, we seem to be able to find mind, at least at first glance, there seems to be consciousness and awareness. Hard to pinpoint what it is exactly, but most Buddhist teachings will say there's not a truly fixed, abiding, independent self, but there's mind. And now this particularly mind-only tradition has this storehouse consciousness that we could say it's individual in the sense that there's not just one storehouse of the whole world. There's like, it's unique to each living being, humans and other and non-human living beings each have a unique storehouse consciousness. which is not really their self, because it's not a fixed thing. It's, there's no essence at the core. The storehouse consciousness is simply the collection of all accumulated experiences that we've ever had. And if we, so we could call that self in a quotes. Like we could say, well, myself is just the accumulation of all my experiences. But it's not like some fixed independent thing. It's constantly changing and there's no core basis of it. It's just a collection. So that's kind of one way of talking about this storehouse consciousness. It's individual, but it's not a fixed self. And then you said, is that like a true suchness? And this particular, usually in the mind-only tradition, it's emphasized that the storehouse consciousness is like the storehouse of all delusions, because that's all our experiences virtually are dualistically constructed delusions. So that's what it's storing up, and that's what keeps the process of delusion going. But in this particular sutra, it's unique. The Lankavatara Sutra starts playing with this idea that this storehouse of delusion is also like, you know, seen from a different angle, you could say, it's actually the storehouse of Buddha. The storehouse of Buddha, the womb of the Tathagata, or Buddha nature itself. So it gets very dynamic to say, you know, it's like, it's the potential, we might say, it's a little off to say it exactly like that, but something like the potential for Buddhahood is this actually deluded mind, this storehouse of all these illusions, is itself the basis, we could say, for realization of complete non-dual freedom and beneficence of Buddhahood. And how that's so, we'll have to see. So, you can, as we finish, after we finish the talk, you can check your cup and see if there's anything left in it.
Practical, the book is available where?
The Lankavatara Sutra is available, I know, like, on Amazon. It probably will be coming out in bookstores soon, but I think it's probably not in stores yet. But it's, you know, it was pre-ordered for many months, and a couple other people said they got like yesterday and today. So it's just, it'll probably be at a bookstore near you soon. Red Pine is a wonderful translator who I think has come to Santa Cruz Zen Center. Has he come here to talk? He also translated the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra and Bodhidharma's teaching and the Six Ancestors' teaching. The Platform Sutra, yeah. He said this was like the hardest thing for him ever, this Lankavatara Sutra. He said he kept like resisting it, and somebody would say, well, can you do like a commentary on the Heart Sutra? And he's like, sure, let me put that one aside. And then he'd keep, I still got to do this Lankavatara Sutra. And then he said he was kind of running low on cash, and a publisher said, we really like a Lankavatara Sutra. I said, we'll give you an advance if you translate it. And he's like, I could use the cash. He confesses in his preface and says, he says, probably many great books have been written in that way that maybe wouldn't have otherwise. We dedicate this discussion to the realization of no external world for all living beings. Beings are numberless. I to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.